Thank you for standing by, and welcome to the United Malt Group Limited FY21 Annual Results Conference Call. All participants are in a listen-only mode. There will be a presentation followed by a question-and-answer session. If you wish to ask a question, you will need to press the star key followed by the number one on your telephone keypad. I would now like to hand the conference over to Mr. Mark Palmquist, Managing Director and CEO. Please go ahead.
Thanks, Rachel. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to United Malt's Fiscal Year 2021 Results Conference Call. We appreciate your ongoing interest in the company. I'm Mark Palmquist, CEO of United Malt. I'm joined on the call today by Amy Spanic, our CFO. Our agenda for today, I will start with a safety performance update and then a discussion of the overview and highlights of the year. Amy will discuss the financial performance in more detail, including profit and loss, balance sheet, and cash flow statements. I will conclude with an update on the continued progress of our growth strategy and outlook for the year ahead. We're happy to take questions at the end. In the safety on slide four of the presentation. During FY21, we reported a reduction in total number of injuries from 16 to 14, and also a reduction in the recordable frequency rate of injuries from 1.45 to 1.42. However, we experienced an increase in the lost time injury frequency rate. The frequency rate was impacted by the loss of nearly 230,000 exposure hours due to site consolidation and closure. Nonetheless, we're focused on improving our performance in this area, together with the development of our long-term safety strategy. On the next slide, I'd like to just give you an overview of the year. EBITDA at $123.3 million was consistent with the guidance we provided on 1 September. Note this includes one-off items and the impact of the new IFRIC accounting pronouncement where software as a service or SaaS costs now have to be expensed as opposed to capitalized. Stripping out one-off costs and SaaS, underlying EBITDA was $137.2 million, down 11% on the prior year. We had the FX impact on the translation of earnings into Australian dollars. On a constant currency basis, underlying EBITDA was down 6% on the prior year. We had a significantly improved performance in the second half on a constant currency basis, particularly in the warehouse and distribution business, and that creates some good momentum into fiscal year 2022. We expect volumes to start to recover to pre-COVID levels post the first quarter of this year with a corresponding improvement in product mix. We're making good progress on the business transformation program to deliver the $30 million in net benefits by fiscal year 2024. And as we complete the major CapEx projects in FY22, we'll start to see an uplift in earnings. The balance sheet remains strong, operating cash flow is positive, and that has enabled the board to declare a final dividend of 3.5 cents per share. On slide six, let me make some overall comments about our performance and the positive medium-term trends for our business. We delivered a resilient result in FY22 in what continued to be a challenging environment. The processing division was impacted by COVID-19 on-premise restrictions. However, we delivered an improved performance in warehouse and distribution. We're seeing some more positive trends emerging across our core geographies as on-premise venues start to reopen, and we remain well-placed to leverage this momentum. For the medium term, the fundamentals for malting remain positive. That has not changed. Beer remains a significant beverage category and is expected to grow further while we are seeing continued growth in craft beer and ancillary products. And of course, distilling continues uninterrupted with our customers laying down spirits for 10-plus years for aged whiskey, the premium. Finally, we have a clearly defined strategy, which includes our capital projects and business transformation program, which will deliver earnings uplift over the medium term. So while we have some short-term disruptions, we remain positive on the medium term, and we're confident in our strategy to capitalize on these trends and deliver sustainable earnings growth over time. Now let's look at slide seven. While we have been managing the impacts of COVID on the business over the past year or so, we're now starting to see positive trends coming forward in our core markets. Our experience in the second half shows that as restrictions ease, there is a corresponding lift in volume, and that augurs well for FY22 and beyond. Beer is a significant beverage category, and consumption is expected to grow as conditions normalize. The outlook is improving in North America for beer consumption, including the craft market. Asian malt export demand will recover at the medium term, with vaccination rates increasing, easing of restrictions. However, we still have some supply chain constraints remaining. Our distilling business is largely unaffected as distillers continue to focus on a longer-term horizon, laying down their spirits for 10-plus years. And craft brewers are innovating and expanding into new channels through packaged product. In an overall sense, market trends are improving. So with that, I will hand over to Amy, and she'll discuss the financials in more detail starting on slide 9.
Thank you, Mark. This slide gives the total profit and loss picture for the year. Revenue was down 4% on volume declines, reflecting the COVID lockdowns and restrictions. And on a constant currency, revenue was in line with the prior year. As Mark said, underlying EBITDA, including one-offs and software as a service, or SaaS, was down 21%, consistent with the guidance that we provided in September. That number includes $3.1 million in costs associated with the Grantham site closure, transformation costs of $4.3 million, and also $6.5 million in SaaS costs, which now have to be expensed under the new accounting pronouncement. Corporate costs reflect a full year post-merger, although lower than expected. Excluding these one-offs in fiscal year 21 and also the one-offs in fiscal year 20, underlying EBITDA was down 11% on the prior year. On a constant currency basis, underlying EBITDA was down only 6% for the year. We announced in September that we would incur significant items for the year. This included a provision for stock loss of $4.7 million related to a UK grain storage contractor which entered administration, and a $16.4 million bad debt provision for an Asian customer. Together, these totaled $21.1 million pre-tax. The effective tax rate was higher, and that reflects the future increase in the UK tax rate, which has impacted deferred tax, and also the fact that we have limited recognition of tax losses as deferred tax assets in Australia. So all up, underlying NPAT was $34 million compared to $57.4 million for FY20. Notwithstanding a challenging year, our ongoing strong financial position enabled the board to declare a final dividend of 3.5 cents per share unfranked, which will be paid on 17 December, bringing the full-year dividend to 5.5 cents per share. This represents a payout ratio of 48% of underlying NPAT for fiscal year 21, compared to 40% in the prior year. Moving on to slide 10 with our earnings waterfall, this is the EBITDA bridge, which shows the key movements in our earnings. The point to highlight here is around the improved second half performance in FY21 compared to the second half of FY20. On a constant currency basis, there was a 9% lift in underlying EBITDA, excluding SaaS costs. The processing variance is attributed to delayed sales as a result of the trade disruption, and the business continues to address the short-term COVID and other impacts. And that is reflected in the improved underlying performance, particularly in the warehouse and distribution business. As Mark said, that provides a good platform into FY22. The right-hand side of the chart will help you to bridge the results, including the one-off items, to get to the underlying EBITDA results consistent with the guidance we provided in September. It's important here to call out that the Grantham closure and the transformation costs were in the first half of 21 and included as part of the $52.7 million. There is also additional information around this provided in the appendix. Moving on to slide 11, we'll look at the individual segments. First of all, processing. Revenue was down 5%, reflecting volume declines, while EBITDA declined by 29% from the impact of the volume and mix. Excluding one-offs and SaaS costs, EBITDA was down 18% and down 13% on a constant currency basis. Earnings were also affected by higher costs associated with implementing hygiene and social distancing measures to keep our workforce safe, as well as higher costs for operating at reduced utilization rates and impact of the freight delays around export sales from Australia and Canada. Moving to warehouse and distribution on slide 12, we had much improved results in this segment. Revenue was steady on the prior year, but EBITDA, excluding one-off costs and SaaS, was up 18% with improving volume and sales mix, particularly in the second half, driving improved margins as craft brewers reopened. On a constant currency basis, EBITDA, excluding one-off costs and SaaS, was up 26%. Earnings also benefited from our optimization program to drive lower operating costs and also from a positive performance of specialty ingredients, reflecting growing demand for ancillary products in craft beer, hard seltzer, and food applications. As a result, EBITDA margin was up nearly 200 basis points to 12.4%. Moving to slide 13, the group remains in a strong financial position. Inventories were higher due to the timing of the United Kingdom harvest and higher global barley prices. Working capital is in line with the second half seasonal unwind that we generally experience. Receivables were lower than the prior year and in line with the significant item provision, in addition to improved collections and timing of receipts. Net debt at 30 September was $312.4 million, which was down from $344.1 million at 31 March. Our gearing ratio is 2.1 times, which is within our target ratio of 2 to 2.5 times, reflecting the seasonal impact of our working capital. We maintain comfortable headroom within our covenants, and we have no significant near-term refinancing commitments. Moving to the operating cash flow on slide 14, we were cash flow positive for the year, notwithstanding the difficult environment. The movement and the change of working capital reflects our fiscal year 21 being a more normal year. The prior year benefited from a change in procurement within our warehouse and distribution segment. The proceeds from inventory funding in FY21 reflect the drawdown in Australia and also the earlier harvest in the UK. It compares to the repayment of the facility in FY20. Lower interest reflects a full year capital structure post the demerger, while taxes paid were higher due to the timing of payments. And with that, I hand it over to Mark to give an overview of our strategy and market outlook.
Great. Thanks, Amy. We'll be on slide 16. And I just want to walk through executing our strategy. Notwithstanding a challenging year, we continue to implement our strategy for growth. Our strategy is clear and consistent and targets high-value markets where the long-term outlook for growth remains supportive. Our strategy is focused on three areas: optimizing the core, transforming for tomorrow, and creating new value. Over the next few slides, I will detail the major initiatives we're implementing to grow the business and generate sustainable shareholder value creation over the medium term. So on slide 17, this summarizes the key initiatives that we're implementing. Now, some of you will have seen some of these you will have seen before, and some of them are new, which reflects the evolving nature and progress of our strategy. I'll talk to some of these initiatives in more detail over the next few slides. And I'll also provide some detail on how we are expanding our capabilities in Canada with a new specialty ingredient processing plant to support the growing demand for new products in craft beer, hard seltzer, and food application. Moving to the next slide, our project in Scotland to expand our capacity for the distilling market is continuing. The expansion at Arbroath is now complete, and it has delivered an additional 22,000 tons of production capacity and is performing to our expectations. Inverness will provide an additional 57,000 tons to service the distilling market. The site is expected to be operational by July, August 2022. That's slightly behind schedule due to some ongoing COVID-related social distancing requirements on the site and some supply chain disruptions on delivery of construction materials. The revised overall cost to complete the Scottish project is $127 million. COVID has caused higher material and supply chain costs and a tight labor market where there's also has been an adverse foreign exchange impact as well. The capacity upgrade is underpinned by expanded contracts with major customers, and based on the current forward order secured, project returns will be preserved. We expect an incremental EBITDA of $18 million in FY23. Now looking at craft beer is a good opportunity for us, and we continue to make progress in this segment. We've expanded our partnership with distribution partner Beermax to further grow our penetration into Mexico. Beermax opened its third warehouse in October of 2021. With demand increasing for reliable and readily available craft brewing products, we believe this partnership provides a good opportunity for us to further diversify our earnings into a growing geography. In Australia, our new craft warehouse and distribution center in Derma has been operational since June, and it provides an expanded range of ingredients and the one-stop shop experience for customers. Now looking at transformation. During the year, we announced our transformation program, which is focused on renewing our organization and technology platforms to create a simplified, more efficient, and effective organization. We commenced stage one in this program, incorporating a redesign of our organizational structure. That includes the appointment of a new chief operating officer, allowing the amalgamation of our U.S. and Canadian processing operations, and a new vice president of human resources. We have also commenced the development of our new ERP and implementation of a transportation management system to enhance our data analysis and process improvement. Total expense on these systems is expected to be $20 million over 3 years, with $6.5 million incurred in fiscal year 21. We are targeting $30 million in net benefits in EBITDA by FY24 for the transformation project. Now on to the topic of sustainability, slide 21. We remain committed to sustainability. Our second sustainability report was published today, which details our progress over the past year. Just a few highlights I would like to point out. We made continued progress on diversity with an improvement in female participation across the company and also at the executive level. Recognizing the risks and opportunities that climate change presents, we have started work on aligning our climate change reporting with the Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosures, or TCFD. We enhanced our supplier onboarding, due diligence, compliance training, and review of modern slavery risks in our supply chain. Moving on to the last section, I want to talk about outlook. I'm going to start with just some market observations. I'll provide you an overview of what we currently see across our different markets. In an overall response, we are seeing continued recovery in on-premise consumption in North America, a recovery in Asia, and an ongoing long-term demand for whiskey, which gives rise to an improving market outlook. By region specifically, in North America, there is continued recovery in on-premise channels, with reopening of bars, restaurants, and stadiums. While winter is approaching, this is in context of much higher community vaccination rates than we had last year. We announced in the trading update in September that the Canadian barley crop was affected by drought. The overall crop size reduction has caused higher barley prices globally. In response, we have proactively sourced barley from Denmark and Australia to supplement our locally sourced supply. The imported barley will support our requirements to meet our customers' demands in both quality and supply. We expect to receive our first cargo early in calendar 2022. We anticipate a cost impact of $8 to $12 million in FY22 for additional supply chain costs from importing barley. In the UK, distilling is continuing uninterrupted, focused on the long-term laying down of spirits. You have seen media reports of higher energy costs in Europe, particularly in the UK. We adopt a portfolio view of the energy cost outlook, and where appropriate, we lock in or hedge energy costs. In the UK, which represents 20% of our production volume, the majority of the customer contracts in the region incorporate energy price indexing. In Australia, you'll see firsthand the reopening over the past recent weeks, and with summer approaching, that gives us some confidence and an improved outlook for domestic malt demand. In Asia, While there are some early signs of restrictions easing in some geographies, freight availability and cost remain an issue for this export market. Asia represents 11% of our sales. Now switching over to CapEx on slide 24. I'll provide an update on our CapEx program for both FY21 and an outlook for FY22. Total CapEx in FY21 was $103 million, which was below our forecast of $120 million due to some COVID delays to projects and also the fact that SAS has now been expensed. I've already mentioned the Scottish capacity expansion project. As part of our strategy to create new value through new product development, we have commenced a project to build a new specialty ingredient processing plant in Calgary. This will target the growing demand for new products in craft beer, hard seltzer, and food. The facility will cook, flake, and bake adjunct products for our craft customers. This growth in the use of adjuncts is driven by a shift in craft production from traditional all-malt beers, for example, pale ales and IPAs, for lighter beers and new styles of beers like hazies and sours. The products also have significant application in food production, and we're excited about the new non-brewing customers that this will add to our portfolio. We're also committing CapEx to projects that will enhance our sustainability through more efficient water and energy use, which has obvious cost savings as well. We're implementing a pilot called OptiSteep technology at our Pocatello plant in Idaho. OptiSteep is an integrated water treatment system for steeping water in malting plants. It allows for germination to take place using less water. These and other projects are expected to be completed in FY22, with project returns meeting our hurdle rates for FY23. We are also continuing the upgrade of the Perth kiln with $8.5 million of spend delayed from last year to FY22. For FY22, we expect total CapEx of $110 million. This year represents the peak of our CapEx cycle, with growth projects delivering earnings uplift from FY23, including the $18 million from the Scottish project that I had mentioned earlier. So looking at the medium-term outlook, we expect improved market conditions as higher vaccination rates support reopening of key markets and consumer channels. Although a patchwork of COVID-19 constraints are likely to continue into FY22. Importantly, the challenges we have seen in the past 18 months or so are not structural. There has been no change to consumers' desire for malted beverages. Beer remains an affordable luxury and a significant beverage of choice. We expect volumes to approach FY19 levels post first quarter FY22 with gradual improvement in the product mix. While the market outlook is looking more positive over the medium term, we're also working hard to optimize the business to not only leverage this improvement, but also to enhance our efficiencies and our effectiveness to generate further earnings growth. Our transformation program remains on track to deliver $30 million net benefits by FY24, and as I mentioned on the previous slide, the growth CapEx projects will also deliver earnings accretion. So let me conclude with a summary of FY21 and how we're positioned going forward. We delivered a resilient result in FY21 and what were challenging market conditions impacted by COVID-19 restrictions. However, we delivered a much improved performance in the second half, and that provides positive momentum into FY22. Our larger markets are starting to return to pre-COVID-19 conditions, with volume expected to approach FY19 levels post first quarter FY22 with continued improvement in product mix. We are focused on leveraging these improving market conditions whilst managing short-term volatility in freight, barley crop, and energy costs. Our CapEx spend is nearing the end of its peak cycle, with the Scottish distilling expansion completed by July-August 2022, and will provide incremental earnings uplift in FY23. And our strategic initiatives will deliver a stronger competitive platform for medium-term growth. And that concludes the presentation, so we're now happy to answer your questions. Thank you.
Thank you. If you wish to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone and wait for your name to be announced. If you wish to cancel your request, please press star 2. If you are on a speakerphone, please pick up the handset to ask your question. Your first question comes from John Campbell from Jefferies. Please go ahead.
Hi, Mark and Amy. Just a sec, I've got to fix up my speakerphone. Can you hear me okay?
Can hear you great.
Hello? Yeah, okay. Thanks, guys. Just a couple of questions. Firstly, you've called out that volumes are going to get back to pre-COVID levels sort of post-Q1. Just in terms of the mix shift, would you expect to be back at the pre-COVID sort of mix between craft and mainstream by the end of FY22? Is that a reasonable expectation?
Yeah, John, our expectations are really built on as long as we don't get into any major, I'll call back to some restrictions that could hurt the on-premise, that we would expect our mix to approach the traditional levels that we've had in the past.
Yeah, and presumably that's going to be a more important driver of profitability than the sort of incremental 5% volume recovery.
Yeah, it really does make a difference. As many of you know, the craft business certainly has a higher margin to it based upon the speciality of it, and also a lot of those products that we have are customized, and so we have good stickiness with our customers.
Yeah. And look, just around the CapEx program, just two questions, Mark, if that's okay, and then I'll pass it over to someone else. But, you know, you've had this sustainability and efficiency CapEx the last X number of years. I mean, it sort of seems like it's almost stay-in-business CapEx. Why shouldn't it be classified as stay-in-business CapEx? Why do you separately call it out? Does that imply that it's coming to an end and that we can assume beyond 22 that doesn't sit there anymore, that CapEx line?
No, I think the cap line or the line on the CapEx will continue. We'll keep looking for other sustainability projects that we can work on, John. So in the case of OptiSteep, you know, that's not a stay in business. It's actually a new process for us that creates efficiencies in use of the water and also allows germination to take place with a lower moisture level in the barley, which means that we get savings on energy use in the kiln because it just takes less amount of energy to dry it to that 4-5% level. And we'll continue to look for projects like that are certainly beneficial, in this case, drop use of water, but it's also cost-effective and generates returns for us.
Yeah, so from our perspective, we should look on any CapEx within that line as effectively just as good and just as incremental to earnings as your straight growth CapEx, such as the Scottish distilling expansion.
Yes, we're looking for these type of projects that meet our minimum hurdle rates for returns.
Yeah, okay. And just last question from me. So in terms of, you know, you've called effectively that the growth CapEx will be completed by the end of FY22. So for 23, we should just assume stay in business and a bit of sustainability CapEx, and that's it, no other major projects.
Yes, and certainly we're working with our board and trying to take a look at what other projects would make sense for us to do and then figure out what the timeline is on that. But, that's where we call out the fact that we're hitting our peak we don't have any major projects that are sitting in an improved basis right now.
Yeah, okay. Thanks for that. I'll pass it over to the next person. Thanks, Mark.
Yeah, thanks, John.
Thank you. The next question is from Apoorv Sehgal from UBS. Please go ahead.
Good morning, Mark, Amy and Renee. This first question from me around corporate costs, please. The guidance of the first half result was for about 12 mil of corporate costs. You came in at $7 million, so a pretty big delta. Just wondering what's changed there. And then what drives the increase of $10 million of corporate in FY22? And is that sort of meant to hold as the go-forward rate beyond FY22 as well?
I'll go ahead and take that one. With regards to the FY21, much of the reduction was having to do with successful insurance renewals that we were able to experience that was able to reduce the amount of those corporate costs. It also had to do with reduced board travel and some compensation or employment benefits, resulting in that amount for FY21. As we go into FY22, it's mainly that insurance renewal that we are able to carry forward that has gone from the historical $12 million down to the $10 million. But there is that growth from FY21, as we are anticipating that there will be the board travel that we did not have in this current year with the restrictions, and then returning to a more employment benefit and compensation level.
Okay, so beyond FY22, should we expect that $10 million to sort of go up a little bit because of the travel going back?
Apurv, can you please restate the question?
Oh, sorry. I'll just follow up on that. Were you saying that beyond FY22, that corporate cost line should be pretty stable or increase a little bit more?
We would anticipate that it would be pretty stable at that $10 million
point. Got it. Okay. And my second question, you're expecting an incremental $8 to $12 million of logistics cost in FY22, which is about 60 to 100 basis points impact the margins. Was there any, a few parts of this question if I can, was there any cost you've incurred in FY21 related to that issue? And is there any offset to it, like any pass through any of that through to your customers? And then just finally, if I can, is it something that's confined to FY22, that incremental headwind, or could it flow into 23 as well?
Yeah, to answer the first question. So the price risk on the malt itself is borne by our customer. Our risks are having the supply and the quality. So we've had to do this in the past. Just think of the droughts in Australia. We had to move considerable tonnage from Western Australia over to the East Coast. And so those are the costs that we have. Now, are there ways to offset that? One of the reasons that we're bringing in this higher quality malt is so that we can have some blend opportunities with some of the domestic barley. So we'll see how that goes. Also, our first vessel is coming in the beginning part of the calendar 2022. So we keep looking at what can we do to improve this imported supply chain, which is a pretty extraordinary event, certainly at the tonnage and the volumes that we're at. In regards to FY23, it's highly dependent upon if we get a normal crop in Canada. And if we do, there'd be very little carryover into FY23 because our fiscal year coincides with when the new crop comes off. So, you know, could there be 30 days in there as we transition from the imported barley to the new crop? That's a possibility, but generally speaking, it should be pretty immaterial. And as we get further along in the year, if we think that's any different, we'll certainly let you know.
Cool. And just one final question, please. Just on volumes. Now, previously, your group volumes were tracking at 95% of pre-COVID levels. Are you able to comment on where we're sitting today? And you've also said that you're expecting an improvement post first quarter 22. So does that mean that your expectation is that we get the flat versus pre-COVID levels in second quarter 22?
Yeah, we would be hopeful. So again, if the restrictions keep coming off in Asia, and if we don't see any material issues of on-premise being restricted in the Northern Hemisphere in the winter months, then we would anticipate that. We call it out because the first quarter is still dealing with a little bit of a hangover on the Asian restrictions. And for most of our customers sitting in the Asian region, it takes them roughly 45 to 60 days to get their supply chains back up and running, particularly with some of the delays with containers and getting a ride on a vessel seems to be the biggest struggle there at the moment. But we are seeing some positive comments as well as sales starting to pick up in that region. Now we just got to see it pick up in the shipment side, and we're anticipating we'll see that after the first of the year.
Thank you. The next question comes from David Pobucky from Macquarie Group. Please go ahead.
Good morning, Mark, Amy and Renee. Thanks for taking my questions. Just to follow up on the previous volume question, so at 95% of pre-COVID levels for the year on average. Are you able to share any comments on the run rate over the course of the year and where you're at by geography, please?
Yeah, I'd be happy to do that. One is, even when we went through COVID in its first waves that came through, we still had a pretty seasonal aspect of how volumes run. Granted, there are lower volumes, but it's that seasonal aspect of things where, because 60% of our volume is sitting in North America, that's where we feel the biggest impact. And so brewers start to ramp up typically latter part of Feb and into March and then go strong, and it's for obvious reasons. They're building inventories for summer consumption, which is a higher rate of consumption of beer in the Northern Hemisphere. So that, we think, is obviously still in place. And we certainly see it with the craft guys as well. So the seasonal aspects of this thing will have the same curve. The front end of what we're experiencing in the half year is really feeling a little bit of the impact of the Asian region, and where they're just starting to come off of restrictions. It still is impacted by the supply chain disruptions. And so the issue will be is how much of that demand was destroyed or how much of it is delayed. Now, we do believe that most of the brewers in the Asian region have not restocked for two reasons. One is, of course, they weren't sure when restrictions were coming off. But the second reason is that container rates have gone up so high that there hasn't been any incentive for them to restock. So we could see actually I would say a bigger increase than we normally would coming out of that region in the first and second quarters of the calendar year. So that's a possibility that we would see that would come forward. The other thing that I would say in terms of North America is we don't think there's been any restocking on inventories there as well. So once everyone gets comfortable that demand is going to stabilize, that COVID is being dealt with effectively, there's always a potential of having some restock. But I just caution any big move on that, just because malt prices are so much higher this year that we could see where they probably wait to restock until they come into when the new crop comes off in October and November.
Thank you, Mark. Second question. Despite the lockdowns, it looks like microbrewers still contributed 35% to group revenue versus 34% last year, as per that graphic that you've got in the account. So it looks like revenue held up relatively well from a group relativity perspective. So just trying to understand that dynamic in the context of the COVID background, and any comments you can make on kind of product mix impacts on earnings for that customer kind of segment, despite revenue holding up relatively well.
Yeah, I'm just making sure I understand. I think yours was in reference to the warehouse and distribution segment.
I think the pie charts that you've got in the accounts for 35% of group revenue references both segments there. Yeah, look, maybe if you can touch on warehouse and distribution, that'd be great, please.
Yeah, I apologize. I'm not getting the question clearly. Let me just make some comments. I think if I was understanding this part of it here is making reference to the restrictions and yet the improvements that we see going on, and that would be for warehouse and distribution is what I thought you were asking. I just want to make sure I had that right.
Yeah, I'm just quoting the pie chart in the accounts where it says 35% of micro brewers. That was the composition of kind of group revenue by customer group. That was pretty stable kind of year on year, 35% of group revenue. that microbrew segment. That's okay. We can take that offline. If that's all right. And Mark, maybe just last one for me, if I may. What sort of growth in mainstream beer and craft beer consumption would you expect over the next few years across your key geographies?
I've got your first question now. I'm understanding a little bit that you're in reference to what we had in the annual report. So let me walk through that one first. So, from a microbrew aspect, from our craft guides, we've actually been very pleased, very happy that we've seen the resilience. When we went through COVID-19, one of the problems that we're having or that we're concerned about is that we'd have a lot of that marketplace to disappear and a lot of the craft guys would go out. But we have not seen that. We've seen them come back strongly. And so we feel very comfortable when you look at that customer group sitting at 35%. We would hope that we'd actually grow that a little bit more outside of our portfolio, particularly if we get back to the more traditional product mix. So we still think that there's very good resistance there. Or resilience is what I should say. And so we would look for that number to actually grow a little bit from where it's at right now.
Thanks, Mark.
Yeah, sorry about the kind of a poor connection here during that stall.
Thank you. The next question comes from Richard Barrick from CLSA. Please go ahead.
Oh, g'day, Mark and Amy. I wanted to talk to you about the warehouse and distribution, the margin that you achieved, because it would appear that the strong growth in the specialty ingredients underpinned the real jump up in that EBITDA margin. So I guess, correct me if I'm wrong there, but if I am right, then if this is it's a mixed effect that's going on within that business, just be keen to understand how sustainable you believe that is, and is it fair to expect that this lift in margins should take it up to a new normal given the new mix?
Yep. So there's actually two things going on that's improved the margin. So you're right. One of it is that we're seeing very good growth in the specialty products area, but the other place is that we're actually starting to capture a lot of the optimization that we've been working on for the past 2 years. And so it's starting to work its way into the bottom line. So we're also seeing better margins just on our core products as a result of it. So it's a little bit of reduction of our costs, some SKUs or stock keeping unit rationalization, and also an improvement in terms of our freight. We've been able to optimize a lot of our inbound and outbound freight coming out of our distribution centers. So it's actually a combination of the two. And we do believe it's sustainable. First, the improvements that we've made in the optimization, we think those are ongoing, and we'll be able to see those on an annual basis. And on the specialty ingredient side, we see that continuing to grow as well. We have a lot more market share that we could penetrate. And as well as you're seeing this kind of, I would say, just an array of new type of beverage products that are going out in the marketplace, it's helping to create that demand for a lot of these specialty type of products. So they can be anything from adjuncts to different types of yeast, to fruit puree, flaked carbohydrates that can change the viscosity of the beer, it can change the taste, and it can change the feel malt. And so those are all the things that we see going on. But we think warehouse and distribution's got a pretty good run rate to it.
Okay. And in a competitive sense, Mark, are you seeing anything from alternative suppliers or your competitors that worries you or makes you feel like you can't hang on to this margin lift?
No, don't see anything in front of us right now. We think we're well positioned because, again, a lot of this increase in the specialty ingredients is done by a lot of our existing customer base. So this is additive. This is product that they're buying as well as still purchasing the same slightly higher amount that we've been selling them in Moat and Hoff, as an example. So we believe it's actually going to continue.
Okay, and then my second topic I wanted to ask around was the higher energy costs. So you referred to it or referenced it as an issue within the UK only, it would seem, but then it also, the way you sort of worded the commentary, it's like, well, there's higher energy costs, but, you know, we're not, you know, it's the customers that would be copping that rather than impacting United Malt. So I guess my question is there an issue or are you seeing any impact in other regions? And to what extent are higher energy costs going to be a drag on your margins? Or should we be thinking about this as the customers basically wearing the impost by the way that those costs are actually contracted?
Yeah, I appreciate you asking that question. I highlighted the UK just because everyone's been hearing about the just massive increases in the natural gas and electrical costs. So just wanted to say that we had pretty good coverage on that. We're seeing the higher energy costs in other regions just because energy costs in general are going up and it's much more globally connected, even natural gas is. With LNG. However, it's not a big of a movement for a number of reasons. In North America, a lot of what we have on the electrical side of the markets are regulated, and so they have to be applied for increases. So in the short term, we're not really seeing much impact on us. Natural gas has gone up, but not nearly to the extent that it's gone up in places like the UK. And then also in Australia, we are seeing a little bit of increase from a natural gas perspective. But today, they're not, I would say, material. Our greater concern is if the energy costs stay at these type of levels, that it will be something that we're going to have to look at on a more medium or long term. And not just understand what the impact is, but what we can do to minimize that impact.
Mm. So is that something that you think you'll get resolution on over the course of this year, or does it feel like it's a longer dated factor?
In regards to the energy costs, I mean, that's a good question.
Visibility, resolution, and how you respond.
Yeah, I just give you my opinion on it is I think it could wear a longer than a year, but I'm not sure it's going to stay at the levels that we have seen. There's just been, you know, a number of disruptions. There has been a startup issue that has gone on with a lot of exploration and production went out during COVID, and it's just taking the energy industry a while to get themselves ramped back up again. So I think it's solvable. It just sitting at the rates that we're at today, it's going to take a little time to get those worked out.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you. The next question comes from Mark Topi from Select Equities. Please go ahead.
Hello. My first question just around malt exporting into the US and given your base in Australia, do you think that enhances your competitive position given some of the smaller malt production companies in the US who mightn't have the same global access?
Yeah, I do think it is an advantage for us. Not just the capabilities to bring it in, but because we have multiple facilities in North America, and so we have the opportunity to be able to move our domestic supplies around and use them in the best manner. And we also have the ability to hit a lot of customers because we're national based and we have the distribution centers as well. So, yeah, I do think it's an advantage. In the marketplace itself, because we are importing malt barley coming in, which is all of very good quality and gives us the opportunity to assure our customers that we're delivering on what they need to be able to produce their beer effectively, but also it gives them confidence that we have the supply so that they're not going to be in a position where we're going to run out of supply and they're not going to have the ability to find malt elsewhere. And so I absolutely do believe it's an advantage for us. I would hope that our customers would see just the challenges that we're going through to be able to meet their needs, that they'll remember that as things start to get more normalized going forward.
Right. And in terms of the Asian doubtful bad debt, can you give us any update there? Is there any scope for clawback on that bad debt?
We're still working through it, so I can't give you any specific comments on it as we're still looking at every legal areas that we can get some of that clawback. That's probably the best I can give you for right now, but we'll certainly update you on any events that take place in future.
And in terms of the structure in the industry in the U.S., we've seen Lion or Little Creatures make a further acquisition there, Bell's Brewery. I'm just wondering, any implications? Do you see that as a positive, perhaps, or adverse, in the sense of that Lion might rationalise its suppliers or rationalise to fewer suppliers or more scale suppliers from be a positive from your point of view?
Yeah, it's an interesting question because it's one that we keep looking at and trying to see if it has an impact. To date, we haven't seen any change in behavior in terms of how these craft brewers that are bought up by someone like Lion Nathan, as an example, buying Bell's. They understand that what they're buying is not just a brand, but they're also buying this customized, specialized type of craft beer. And so most of the purchases that have been made is they leave it alone because they don't want to hurt the demand for that brewery or for that particular brewery. What they are doing is it does give better access and more efficient access and distribution, so they can tend to expand product availability. So from our standpoint, when we see good, successful craft brewers, when they get bought up by a big brewer, we don't view that as being negative, because typically what that spells is it's increasing demand with the present customer that we have. And yet we know that they're going to want the product that we're giving them to be able to produce that quality of beer. So to date, we haven't seen that being an issue. We have seen probably a little bit of improvement from a logistical and transportation aspect, because you are getting a bigger economy as a scale, shipping to a bigger unit that's using more malt and other products from us.
Right. And just in terms of Mexico, I'm just wondering if we can expand on the strategy there. It would seem, certainly with higher inflation, that some kind of U.S. companies are moving to Mexico. Do you see further opportunities to expand into Mexico in terms of what you're doing there?
I think I understood your question, and that's about the further expansions into Mexico. Yeah, we absolutely do see that. It's an interesting developments going on in Mexico. We're seeing a higher level of sophistication by the brewers in that area, and they're responding to it because you're getting more and more Mexican citizens that have consumed better quality craft beers or more customized type of beers, either through traveling into the U.S. or maybe going to uni in the U.S., and so they're demanding that on a localized level. And so our partnership with Duramex is actually creating that for them. And we've seen a change just in the last couple of years working with Duramex about the desire and the demand coming for more, I would call it, bigger array of products so that they can produce more customized beers. And Mexico is a good market just from a straight beer consumption aspect. It's growing in beer consumption at a higher rate than what it's growing in the U.S. And the craft consumption, albeit considerably smaller than the U.S., and I would just call it 12, 15 years behind in the U.S., it's growing at double-digit rates, which is very much parallels where the U.S. was in its first 10 years of growing the craft beer business. So we're very optimistic about the further opportunities to expand in Mexico.
And as a base to ship product back into the U.S., does it also offer that opportunity?
Well, that's also an interesting aspect of it. Is it's very possible as we get into more of these specialty products, there's a number of them that can actually be produced in Mexico that we'd want to take across. So you're seeing what's happening in a lot of the specialty tequilas, as an example. There is, for a lot of consumers, particularly in the southern states, they value some production that is made in Mexico. That's certainly, what Constellation Brands does with their Corona, Pacifico, and Modelo labels in the U.S., where they very specifically produce it in Mexico and sell it in the U.S. So there are some possibilities that could develop.
And lastly, just on seltzer, do you think perhaps the boom is, if not over, certainly moderating? We're seeing Boston beer destroy product. Where do you see the seltzer trend from here?
Yeah, seltzer does definitely see, we see it moderating. If I was to look at just the pathway of what cider did when that became a new category, massive peak, super high growth, and then it leveled off pretty quickly. And I don't know if that's what's going to happen to seltzer, but when the on-premise side has started to open up with the restrictions coming down, the seltzer volumes on the retail side, so this would be packaged product, has certainly been dropping. So we'll have to see the data more and just see if that is really creating a trend or not. And I think it's going to take us another 6 months to see what happens. It may develop a fairly similar type of seasonal pattern that we see in a lot of our beer products, and that would be that it's a natural drop-off in the northern hemisphere in the winter months, and then it goes back to increasing in the summer months. We'll just have to wait and see while all that comes out.
Sure. All right. Thank you for that.
Thank you. The next question is a follow-up from Apoorv Sehgal from UBS. Please go ahead.
Hey, guys. Apologies for that before. My phone cut off, and so I missed your answer to my volume question. This one specifically on the warehouse distribution segment, are you able to comment where volumes of that segment is tracking versus pre-COVID levels, please?
Yeah, no, I appreciate that, and I'm also happy that we're hearing you clearer, so we can answer your question. So we are tracking and we are tracking very close to pre-COVID levels, and we'll watch it as it goes over the winter months here and see if it holds pretty good. What we are seeing is that as we're getting more and more of these craft brewers getting comfortable about restrictions on premise side, that we are seeing a lot of the volumes coming back, particularly in the core products, which means that they are selling product, they are seeing the demand. So we've seen good volumes coming back again on the mainstays, so malt, hops, yeast. So that tells us they're brewing. The interesting part is we're also seeing a lot of increase in the ancillary products, which means that they're back experimenting and innovating. which is a good sign because that tells us that they're having confidence and it means that they're getting customers in the door. So they're brewing a higher selection of beers for on-premise. And so we feel very comfortable as we go forward on this. Again, my caveat is always if restrictions come back, but we're seeing the demand come back strong. We're seeing the kind of array of product that people are looking for in the beer category that we feel pretty comfortable that we're going to be back at pre-COVID levels here pretty quickly.
Got it. And I'm conscious of time, but just one final question from me if I can. Just on the transformation benefits. So you've reaffirmed $30 million by FY24. Just wondering, are you still on track for $10 million in FY22?
Yes, we are. So we don't see any change from what we had said earlier about the transformation when we originally announced it. We're on track on the changes we made. We are seeing the improvements that we'll be able to expect as we get the components fully implemented. And the program is still running basically the same way. It's running in stages, so it's not like a big bang at the end of FY24. We are realizing results. So I'm probably answering this longer than I needed to. I mean, the answer is yes, we do think.
Is that the actual amount? Is that $10 million the actual amount you expect to realize, or is it an annualized number, and therefore the amount you actually realize at FY22 is less than 10?
It'll be an annual number, because what we're doing inside of transformation are making fundamental changes, either how we're structured, or what we're doing on the revenue side, and what we're doing on the cost side. So those are per annum. So they're not one-offs where we're just capturing that for 1 year and that's it. So it's additive for us as we go along. And by the time we're at the end of FY24, we think it's an additive $30 million on an annual run rate.
Cool, guys. Thanks for taking my questions.
Thank you.
Thank you. There are no further questions at this time. I'll now hand back for closing remarks.
Yeah, thank you, Rachel. And particularly thank you all for participating today. It was just really important to us so that you understand what's going on. Certainly, we've been through some challenges here, like a lot of companies have, but we can certainly see a pathway out. We're very excited about where we're going, and particularly when we look at, on a medium-term basis, the resiliency that we're seeing coming not just out of our customers, but out of their consumers. Which gives us confidence here that we're ready to get back on track, get things normalized, and as importantly, a lot of the changes that we've made inside this organization through transformation or some of the capital projects we're finishing up, we think sets us very well for the future. So thank you very much again, and we really appreciate your support and really appreciate your interest in the company. Cheers.
Thank you. That does conclude our conference for today. Thank you for participating. You may now disconnect.